Okay, so there are a few more sheets coming up from second class, the sheet for today. There are, Matthew is making a few more right now, so we should have enough of those in a few minutes. If you'll recall from last time, so what we did last time is we began to look at this really critical, central topic of what is a Jew required to believe, and who is a heretic and who is not a heretic, and we'll be talking a little bit about that as we go through the course. We looked last time, just to refresh your memory, we looked at the 13 Ikrim. There's a list on the first sheet of the 13 Ikrim, and I'll mention them again soon. We looked at where the Rambam wrote them, and we looked a little bit at why the number 13. We also then had a little bit of a look at the Yigdal and Ani Ma'amin, which of course was not written by the Rambam, but were summaries made sometime afterwards. And then we finished last time by looking at the Rambam's radical position on heresy, where the Rambam sets out that if a Jew believes that all of these 13 things, the way that he wants you to believe them, even if the Jew does averas and whatever, makes mistakes, they can do tshuva and they have a chelik in Olam Haba. But if a Jew even doubts one of the 13 principles of faith, you can do all the mitzvahs in the world, you can do everything mahadrin and mahadrin and only eat here and only do that and follow this chumrah and that chumrah, is it gornisht helpful? It's not going to help. There's no place in Olam Haba because you made a mistake. Even if, said the Rambam, even if the mistake was accidental. And we raised a question last time, which we're not going to answer yet, but we are going to answer during this course, which is, what about all those people in the world who do not subscribe to, there's one more just arrived, this week, yeah, who do not subscribe to the Yud-Gimel Ikrim through their own education, etc., etc. So we are going to talk a bit more about that, but not for right now. Today, I would like to raise the question with you, why? Why did the Rambam write the Yud-Gimel Ikrim? Why did he feel the need to do what nobody had done, really, since Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain with the Luchos in his hand? For 2,500 years, nobody had written any kind of summary of the Jewish principles of faith. And therefore, why the Rambam felt compelled to do so is the main topic that I have for today. I'd like to suggest six answers to that question. We'll go through them. The first one is the main one, but there are six, and you can take them or leave them, some of the others. And the second thing I want to come on to is, what is the structure of the Yud Gimel Ikrim? And then from next time in Yetz Hashem, this is what I want to map out, what I want to try and do, is I want to go through the Yud Gimel Ikrim, maybe take two per session. We only have, we have in principle 10 sessions. It's not actually 10 sessions, because I won't be giving the last of this group of 5 on December the 28th. There will be classes running all the way through. As far as I'm aware, there is no break. It runs all the way through Hanukkah, and then the next semester starts immediately after, on the beginning of January. But I will not be giving the class on the 28th of December. There will be, I think, Rav Blau. He will be coming back to give that class, which I'm sure will be marvellous. But I won't be here. So we have 4 classes now, and we have 5 classes of the next month. So in those 9 classes, starting from next time, I'm going to take the Ikrim 2 by 2, or sometimes 3, to fit them into the classes that we've got, and highlight some of the real issues that arise there. We're not going to have a chance to get into them in depth, because, you know, this is not the forum for that, but hopefully we will get a chance to get a good overview of them. Thank you very, very much indeed. Okay.
Just a quick announcement. If we have more copies, is it possibly there are more people registered from the beginning of the semester, that if you can please speak to me at the end of class, I'll come by, and then we'll work out the details for registration.
If you don't have it already, you have it. Okay? Okay, we'll say that. All right.
Okay, so now's your moment. If you don't have the sheet, tell me now. Otherwise, that's it. Gone. Okay, fine. The 6 approaches I want to suggest, the first one is the main one, which is what I call here the theology approach, which in essence is that the Rambam had to write the Yud Gimel Ikrim to get us all into Gan Eden. Because according to the Rambam, Judaism lost a lot of the philosophical understanding over time for various different reasons that we once had. And people had become, if you like, focused on doing mitzvahs, which is very, very important, but had lost sight of the fact that the mitzvahs are meant to take you somewhere, and that somewhere is where what gets you into Olam Haba. And the Rambam was concerned that everybody was doing all the mitzvahs, not getting to the somewhere, and therefore not getting to the chelek in Olam Haba. And therefore he needs to schlep us all into Olam Haba, and that's why he writes the 13 Ikrim. And let me explain to you how this works. Have a look, please, in source number 1. What is Olam Haba? Little light questions for a Wednesday morning, okay? But it's important that we get an understanding of what Olam Haba is. Says the Rambam, Ha'olam Haba, he paskins this in Hilchos Tshuva, this is his psak, his halachic psak as to what Olam Haba is like. Ha'olam Haba, ein bo guf ugviya, there is no body or physicality, el nefashos hatzadikim bilvad, just the souls of the tzaddikim. By tzaddikim, he doesn't just mean a small proportion of ultra-pious people. He means everyone, he says in Hilchos Tshuva, everyone who is majority good. So they're a tzaddik, and they get to Olam Haba. Beloy guf, kamalachei hasharis, without any body, like the malachim. The malachim, in the philosophy of the Rambam, the malachim do not and cannot have any physical being at all. The malachim are a purely spiritual thing, which is why the Rambam, since that has to be the case philosophically, that's why the Rambam goes through Chumash and goes through Tanakh, and every time anyone has any kind of interaction with a malach, the Rambam says those psukim cannot be taken at face value because they contradict a fundamental principle of Judaism. The Rambam is not quick to take psukim out of their literal meaning, but he will do when you have to do in order to make them fit with basic fundamental human religious principles. Like, for example, an obvious example is the Yad Hashem. The Yad Hashem, when he talks about the hand of God or the Eini Hashem, or anything like that, the Yad Chazakah Zeroh Netuyah, it doesn't mean God has a big arm and a big hand, etc., but that I think is uncontroversial. What is more controversial is that any time a malach appears in Tanakh, the Rambam says that has to be happening in a nevuah. Has to be. And therefore, you go through the Chumash and you start to re-understand, according to the Rambam, many of the old family favorite stories, and they take on a rather different meaning. For example, the Rambam, with the visits of the three malachim to Avraham at the beginning of Parshas Vayera, does not happen in, if you like, real time. It happens in a nevuah, which actually fits at the beginning of the Parsha rather well, because it says, Vayera Hashem el Avram ve'eloni mamre, God appears to Avram in the Eloni Amre, and it doesn't say what God says to him, which is a textual question. God never appears and says nothing. Rashi explains it by saying God appears to do Bikur Cholim, which is when you can appear to do nothing because you're just there to say, I feel for you. But the Rambam says, no. God appears because the whole of the next chapter is God's vision to Avram. A vision of three angels, a vision of them coming to dinner, a vision of Sarah laughing, a vision of... The whole thing's in a vision because you can't sit down to tea with a malach. You can't, it doesn't work. It doesn't happen. And the Ramban, of course, the Ramban goes ballistic with this understanding, and it says, you can't teach that, you can't say that, you're taking the psukim and you're writing them out of existence. And he asks some pretty good questions on the Rambam, which is, well, where does the vision end? What happens when the malachim go to Sdom? Is that all a vision? Whose vision is that? Lot's vision? The destruction of Sdom? Is that all a vision? Etc. And the Ramban, therefore, has a very big vikuach, a big argument with the Rambam as to whether you can teach this. The irony, of course, is that the Rambam teaches this and many others like it in the Mori Nevuchim. Nobody actually really reads the Mori Nevuchim anymore. The only reason people know this view of the Rambam is because the Ramban on Chumash quotes him and tells you you're not allowed to believe this. So the only reason people know this is because you've been told that you're not allowed to know this. But it's there. I once asked one of my Rosh Yeshivas, the Ramban says, you're not allowed to teach this. Am I allowed to teach the Rambam? So he says, of course, you're allowed to teach the Rambam, Maimonides, as long as you then also teach the fact that Nachmanides says you're not allowed to teach Maimonides. Then everybody's happy. Then you're teaching everybody. But anyway, also in this week's Parsha, which is less controversial, when Yaakov fights with the Malach, that fight is happening, according to many Meforshim, in a nevuah, on a celestial level, rather than on a physical level. But the same is true of Bilam and the donkey. Angels going up and down. That's anyway in a dream, so that's in the psuk. So you have to go through Chumash and work out who's having visions of what, with whom, etc., etc. Anyway, so he says, like a malach, we digress. Hayil the ain boy gvia, since there is no physicality in Olam Haba, ain ba lo yachila, ba lo shtia, ba lo yidavar mat, mikol hadvarim shegufois b'nei adam srichin lehem ba olam hazeh. If you're expecting a sumptuous, chopped liver dinner or whatever it is, or if you're a Muslim and you're waiting for your 70 virgins, so the Rambam says, I'm sorry, ain't happening, Olam Haba is not that kind of a place, okay? Some people prefer the chopped liver dinner, but it depends on you. Ela tzadikim yoshvim v'atreisehim b'roshehim. But the tzadikim are sitting, and their crowns are on their heads. V'nenim iziv ha-shechina, and they're basking in the glow, the radiance of the Shechina. Now, of course, the Rambam contradicts himself. You don't have a head, and you don't have an ability to sit, because you have no body. And he says, therefore, v'zesha amru tzadikim yoshvim v'derechida amru. When it says that tzadikim sit, of course, that is only a moshel, it's a metaphor. And what is the metaphor? Kloima, ha-tzadikim mitzuyim sham b'loy amul b'loy gvir. That you are present there without any effort, you're not going anywhere, you're just existing. If you like, you're stationary, you're sitting down. V'chein, and similarly, zesha amru atrasein b'roshem, and this is a bit I'm really interested in, when it says you have a crown on your head in Olam Haba, what does that mean, says the Rambam? Kalaimer, it means das, the knowledge, sheyedu, which you know, shebiglala, only through that knowledge, you zachu l'chayim Olam Haba, you merit Olam Haba. Matsuyim, that knowledge is with you. Vehi ha'atra shalahem, and atara, this is your atara. This is the essence of you. The Rambam's understanding is that Olam Haba is an existence which is basically the knowledge, the understanding that a person gained in this world through which they merited the next world. No understanding, no next world. And he says clearly in his introduction to Perek Chelek, in number two, I brought this in English, the intent of the statement, the crowns on the head, is the existence of the soul through the existence of what it knows, in that they are the same thing, as the experts in philosophy have maintained. You are what you think. You are what you know. And that's your relationship with Hashem. He'll say later that your ahavat Hashem is also connected with how much you know God. And therefore, if a person does a lot, but thinks very little, that doesn't really get a person to Olam Haba. And therefore, the Rambam, this starting point, is fundamental, which is that the reason that we're focusing so much on what people believe is if your person doesn't eat kosher, okay, they didn't eat kosher, they need to do tshuva, and there's an issue there, and that's going to hold them back a little bit. But if a person doesn't have a head in the right place, they think God has a body, they think there are three gods, they think the Torah was not given on Sinai, they think this, they think that, they think the other, the whole head's messed up, and if the whole head's messed up, that's it, that's the Olam Haba, says the Rambam. That's what you are in Olam Haba. He even said this very explicitly in the Moreh Nevuchim. Send for a second onto page two. It's always difficult to know whether to bring Moreh Nevuchim in Hebrew or in English. Either way, it's a translation. I should read it in the Arabic, which wouldn't really be very impressive because I don't speak a word of Arabic. Therefore, I'm just as happy to read it in English as to read it in Hebrew. It's always an issue as to which translation you're using. The main translations of the English, in English of the Moreh Nevuchim, there's one by Friedlander from the late 1800s, which is available free online. You can just download that. It's not apparently the best translation that there is. A better translation is a two-volume translation by Shlomo Pinez that was brought out in the 1960s, it's a yellow and a green one. That's apparently a better translation, but it's a lot harder to read. You do find that with translations. Sometimes a more accurate translation is very nice, but it reads like a disjointed, dysfunctional piece of English. I'm not saying it's that bad, but it's not great. The best Hebrew translation of the Moreh Nevuchim, there was one recently done by Schwartz, Professor Michael Schwartz, I think he's in Hebrew U, who put one out about 3 or 4 years ago. That's the one that appears in the shops. Interestingly, even in the Frum shops. I don't know quite how that happened. But he managed to get his books into, even you can go get it from Manny's bookstore down in Gola, or you used to be able to anyway. They probably burnt it down now. But you can find his book. It's an excellent Hebrew translation. Now, look at what he says in the top of page two. The third level of perfection, he goes through, different levels of perfection. And he talks about financial perfection, having your finances in order, not being a total wreck, and borrowing more than you can afford to pay back. should have told that one to the European Union. He talks about another level, which is physical perfection, which is making yourself healthy and getting your body in shape so that you can serve Hashem properly. Now, the third and fourth level he's coming on to here. The third level is perfection of moral character traits. Getting your midas straight. And he says an amazing but radical thing. Most of the mitzvahs are solely to achieve this level of perfection. In other words, the reason we do mitzvahs, says the Rambam, is to perfect our midas, to perfect our character traits, so that we can get to the next level, which is this level of perfection, i.e. the third, is itself only a preparation for another and not an end in itself. The fourth level is true perfection of a person, which is the attainment by that person of intellectual virtues, i.e. an intellectual framework from which to learn a true understanding of the divine. This is the ultimate goal and the true perfection of a person which belongs to him alone, through which he may merit eternal existence, and through which he is truly human. Again, the Rambam says, what gets you Olam Haba, eternal existence, is not keeping Shabbos. It's a radical statement. It's understanding why you keep Shabbos. It's the keeping of Shabbos which is fundamental to get you to the next level. If you don't keep Shabbos, he says, you'll never get there, because you won't get to the fourth level. But even if you do keep Shabbos and you keep kosher, etc., that will not get a person to Olam Haba, says the Rambam, unless there is some kind of an intellectual click that happens as a person is keeping Shabbos, and therefore that is turning them into a person connected with a God, a God's Baruch Hu more. Yes? No, because I think he feels that everybody. Why? You can't understand Shabbos? Something. It doesn't mean you have to be Aristotle. The Rambam doesn't say you have to be Aristotle. But he means if you put a mezuzah on the door, and you think, I don't know, something magical happens when I put a mezuzah on the door, it protects my house, I don't know why, I don't know how, I just do it, then that is a mitzvah which doesn't. Is it so hard for the common man to understand that inside the mezuzah it says Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and the reason that the mezuzah is on the door to make every time I walk past it I have to think about the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has made me and put me in the world, and that there's one God, and that there's we came out of Egypt, which is all in the mezuzah, etc. Now, of course, not everyone is going to think that every time they walk past the mezuzah, although maybe we should, although I don't know how that would feel quite if you thought that, went through that thought process every time you walk past the mezuzah, but it should become a little bit more subliminal. But at least there's some level there that the mezuzah is focusing my mind that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, and of course in the merit of the mezuzah and the mitzvah, maybe I have a shmira in Olam Hazah, that's a different issue. But if I think the mezuzah is an amulet, it's like a protective charm that I put on the wall and it just does some magic, I mean, that doesn't get you to any kind of intellectual perfection. And again, I don't think you have to have the Aristotelian intellectual perfection. That's why he's writing it. That's the point. Yes, but I'm not sure that you're underestimating the common man or the common woman. I think most people are capable of understanding Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, that has some kind of meaning intellectually. The RP, again, I'm not setting the bar very high. I'm really not setting the bar very high. I'm saying the idea that we exist and there's a reason for our existence, that Hashem made the world and there's a unity to Hashem, which means there's a unity to exist. These are, I think, the common man, if put in, you don't have to put it in clever, you know, you have to write like Rav Soloveitchik and it's ontological this and epistemological that. I agree, you don't have to do that, but you can put it in straightforward language and put out books. There are loads. The number of art scroll books that there are on this kind of issue gives testimony to the fact that the common man can understand them, because it's the common man that's buying the art scroll books. Art scroll didn't exist, that's why the Rambam wrote the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Yes. Right. And we paskin, by the way, mitzvah srichas kavana. Correct. We paskin on a mitzvah doraita, mitzvah srichas kavana. Which means if I do a mitzvah, I don't even know I'm doing a mitzvah, then I'm not doing a mitzvah. On the very most basic level, that's what the Rambam's talking about. Now, I think the Rambam's talking about a little bit more than that, but it covers everybody, but I'm not sure it's going to quite get far enough that I know I'm doing this, but I don't know. Well, at least it's a mitzvah. Right. Correct. I remember when I was at university, I put a mezuzah on my door, and we had a lady that used to come and clean the room, a non-Jewish woman used to come and clean the room. At the end of my year, she said to me, she said, all of the cleaners in the building have made a bet as to what the thing on your door is. So I said, she said, should I tell you what my bet is? So I said to her, yeah, what's your bet? I thought she was going to give me a shot in the Morin of Uchim or the Rambam or something like that. So she said to me, I think it's an air freshener. I said to her, well, maybe a kind of spiritual air freshener. So she says, you mean I'm right? I said, yeah, that's good enough. Yeah.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
There's always a danger of that. I mean, checking your mezuzahs, and if the mezuzah happens to be posel, then the Rambam will agree that if you put a posel mezuzah up on the door and you walk past it and think those things, then that won't work. Which question is, why not? It won't, you didn't do the mitzvah, and therefore whatever intellectual developments you have on the back of that mitzvah is not a mitzvah. Because you can't get to the fourth level without going through the third level. You see, if you take that argument to its ultimate extreme, then you can just be a Christian. You know, you just forget the mitzvahs, just think all what you need to think. But the Rambam's saying that if you don't do the mitzvahs right, you won't come to think what you need to think. You just won't do it. You have to sit and make sure the mezuzah is written correctly. Now, I agree 100% that if someone has a posel mezuzah, that's something that needs to be changed, because that mitzvah brings with it a certain shmirah, it brings with it a certain schus, and you need the schus of that mitzvah, and that's part of the whole package that helps a person's life. But again, if a person thinks that it's the mitzvah, it's the mezuzah that does the protection, then there comes a point when that borders on avodah zarah, at the very least superstition. Avodah zarah is very osur. Superstition, says the Rambam, is just osur. It's just stupid, because it's osur. And it's an issur d'oraita to be superstitious. So if you walk around with a red band on your wrist thinking that that's going to do it for you, that's going to be everything, so then that's very problematic. Very problematic. Either it's avodah zarah because you think the red band protects you, which I don't think most people think, or it's just plain ignorant superstition because you think it does something but you don't know what it does, and it does nothing other than enrich the people who sell the red bands. Okay, fine. I'll tell you something. I've no idea. Much ink has been spilt on it. I can speculate and tell you my views. And Professor Menachem Kellner from Haifa University, how would the Rambam relate to the Hasidim? Okay? Look, the Kosker Rebbe had a copy of the Morin Nevuchim by his bed. He said it was a work of deep Kabbalah. So it's not so straightforward that the Hasidim and the Rambam are at war with each other theologically. Lubavitch is very into the Rambam in many ways. Professor Menachem Kellner has a thesis which he develops, which I think is very, actually, personally, is very convincing. He's a from Yid, and he's thought about these things very carefully, and he's developed, he's a very interesting academic. His thesis, if you want, he has a book called Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism, which really asks your question. And his thesis is basically this, which is that the Rambam wrote a lot of what he wrote because he felt that there was a creeping mysticism entering into Judaism through things like the Kuzari, a kind of mystical, spiritual version of Judaism which he felt was not authentic. He understands, and he says very specifically in the Morin Nevuchim, that the more philosophical version or rational version of Judaism is the authentic original Judaism. And he wrote the Morin Nevuchim to try and stem the tide of the proto-Kabbalistic kind of creep that was coming in to taking over Judaism. Ironically, says Kellner's thesis, the Rambam, by writing the things that he wrote, did more than anyone else in the world to trigger a massive Kabbalistic backlash, which is what we're living in right now. And therefore, the Rambam, in trying to stem that tide, probably did more than any other man in history to try to help produce the Kabbalistic revolution, which came shortly after the Rambam died, which was the appearance of the Zohar and then the Arizal and the world in which we live today, which is a very Kabbalistic world. That's why, and the book that he writes, he gives like 9 or 10 examples of critical Kashkafic issues where we feel that Judaism works like this, but the Rambam feels that Judaism works like that. And when you quote the Rambam, people go, really? Really? I never heard that. The reason you never heard that is because that's not what we're taught. We're taught the more Kabbalistic side of the Hashkafic issues. We'll talk about some of them as we go through the course. And the Rambam very often has a different way of looking at Hashkacha Prophets, at the nature of Jews and non-Jews, the nature of Eretz Yisrael, the nature of the Hebrew language, the nature of Tumah and Tara, the nature of Kedusha, the nature of many things where we assume that Judaism says X. The Rambam will actually present a rather different view, which people are not used to. Yes. Yes.
Like,
and they were burning his books.
Right, they were burning books in the Vilna Gaon also say very horrible things.
Like, not horrible things. He said that the Rambam made a big mistake. He said he was twisted by his reading of Aristotle.
Right. Yeah, the 13th requirement is something that's so accepted, and the Abchazah, all these things that he wrote are crucial parts of our belief in Judaism and our understanding, and it's just understanding. Some of his things we don't believe, we don't understand, we don't refer to, but yet other
so we've kind of we've reached a kind of stasis, a kind of modus vivendi, where, like I said last week, where we've kind of divided the Rambam into two. There's the Rambam, which we learn, and who's the from one, and there's Maimonides, which they learn in JTS, who he's the non from one, which of course is a bit, it's completely artificial, which is not true, and therefore people have just decided to ignore most of what's written in the stuff that they don't really want to look at. What we've done with the Yud Gimel Ikrim actually is a rather interesting fudge, because we've adopted the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikrim as the cornerstone of what makes you a frum Jew, and we'll see when we look at Rav Moshe Feinstein the way he says one of the key issues that the reform, what's the problem with reform? They don't believe in the Yud Gimel Ikrim. What's the problem with conservative? They don't believe in the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Who wrote the Yud Gimel Ikrim? The Rambam. But actually, when we talk about the Yud Gimel Ikrim, we're not really talking about the ones that the Rambam did. We're talking about those sort of headings, if you like, of these 13 things. But our version of the 13 Ikrim that we often subscribe to is far from the version that the Rambam actually wrote. Which is funny, because we kind of, as a Jewish people, ended up with a 13 Ikrim, which is not really the Rambam's 13 Ikrim at all. It's the Rambam's idea with somebody else's Hashkofa sort of plugged in. Which I don't think the Rambam would have been desperately impressed with, and I don't think he felt he would have got anyone to Olam Haba. I wonder if Rambam's kind of really lonely in Olam Haba. But I don't know. I mean, but that's what we kind of ended up doing to a large degree. But we'll see. We'll see more as we go on. Please carry on. Let's carry on, please, on page 2. Now, the source number 4 I'm not going to look at in detail. It basically just says that the Rambam understands that we're not expected to do this all by ourselves. There is a way of understanding from other people. Just 1 second, I need to fiddle with this for a second. Oop, did that wrong, because my recording's gone all wrong. There we are. The Rambam agrees that there will indeed be things that we have to learn from other people. We can't just work it out ourselves, otherwise we'll all have to be Aristotle. He's kind of asking your question a little bit. What will the common man do? The common man can't sit down and work out all these things for himself. And he says, let me just draw your attention to 1 or 2 lines in number 4. He says, look in the middle of that paragraph, he says, now if no knowledge whatsoever had been given to us by means of tradition, and if we'd not been brought to a belief in a thing through the medium of parables, we would have been bound to form a perfect notion of things with their essential characteristics, and to believe what we could prove. A goal which could only be attained by long preparation. He's saying if someone had to work this all out for themselves, then, Lord help us all, because we'll never get there. We're just not there. In such a case, most people would die without having known whether there was a God or not. Which some people have that issue their whole lives, as it were. Much less than certain things would be asserted about him, other things about his defects, etc. From such a fate, not even one of a 62 of a family would have escaped. So he says, don't worry. You don't have to be Aristotle. I will tell you what you have to believe. You will do your best to understand what I mean, and then we'll all go to Olam Haba together. Yeah? But you don't have to be Aristotle. Now, there are a couple of places in the Rambam that people raise and they say, well, 1 second. The Rambam is telling you the mitzvahs don't get you to Olam Haba. He doesn't say that. Of course, the classic approach that we all understand is that a mitzvah is exactly what gets you to Olam Haba. The Kabbalistic understanding is that a mitzvah, when you do a mitzvah, it changes things in the Olamas. It makes things work in a different way, whatever it is. And when you appear after 120 years, that mitzvah has fundamentally changed the nature of your spiritual being, so that the mitzvah has brought you into Olam Haba. The Chofetz Chaim talks about this very extensively in the beginning of his Hilcha Shabbos. He brings the famous Medrash that says that there are 613 mitzvahs, just like there are 613 parts of the body. You heard this Medrash before, right? 365 limbs and 248 sinews, or whatever it is. Now the question is, what's going on there? Are there really 613 parts of the body? Only if you want there to be. In other words, it's clearly set up. Because you can count them on parts of the body however you want. You can count them like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Or you can count them on a cellular level and there are millions and billions. So the fact that you get to the number 613 is artificial. So that's...
Well,
okay, that's awesome. That's learned from a pasuk. Torah, Tziva, Lan, and Moshe. It's a Gemara in Makkos. So that already we have a remez for. But the point is that Chazal wanted to make the point that the 613 mitzvahs correspond to bits of you and me. And that when we go to Olam Haba, there's no reward and punishment. The Rand talks about this as well. Other people talk about it. There's no reward and punishment as such. What there is what we made ourselves. If we did this mitzvah, says the Chofetz Chaim, for example. Let's say the mitzvah of, let's say the mitzvah of Shatnez corresponds to your little finger. It doesn't, but let's say spiritually. So you go to Olam Haba, if you kept the mitzvah of Shatnez as well, so your little finger is in good, strong, solid health in the Olam Haba. That's it. The bit of spiritual you that is that bit, that's strong. But if you didn't keep the mitzvah shalas, then you're missing. That bit is just not there. It's either weak or it's withered or it's just not there at all. And therefore, the mitzvahs are exactly what you. The mitzvahs make you, and you are the mitzvahs. That's what happens in Olam Haba. That's how he explains, the Chofetz Chaim explains, Chi of Kores. Kores means a person, some part of their essence is missing, which is not their little finger, but which is something so fundamental like the heart or their brain or their lungs that a person cannot exist in Olam Haba without it. And therefore they cease to exist. That's how he explains Chi of Kores. The Rambam is not coming from there. The Rambam is coming from a place where the mitzvahs are critical to prepare us for the thought, and the thought is what gets us to Olam Haba. Now, there are a couple of places where he seems to say the opposite, which we'll look at now, but you had a question. Fine, let's go. Look at number 5. Says the Rambam in his commentary on the Mishnah in Makkos. He says, one of the most fundamental principles of Torah beliefs, number 5, is that if a person fulfills one of the 613 mitzvahs correctly and appropriately, with no ulterior motive related to this world at all, but rather for the sake of and with the love of God, he merits life in the world to come. Thus, Rabbi Hananiah states that due to a large number of mitzvahs, it is impossible that a person will not do one mitzvah properly during his life, and thus will merit immortality of the soul through this act. So here the Rambam seems to say the opposite of what we've been saying. If you just do one mitzvah properly, that's why there are so many mitzvahs, that everyone can find a mitzvah that they like. No one can turn around and say, well, I looked in Judaism, there wasn't anything for me there. There's just something for everybody, whatever you happen to be connected with. So what does the Rambam mean? So I don't think the Rambam is saying that just doing a mitzvah gets you to Olam Haba. Because if you look at what he says clearly, you have to do it properly. Look at the Hebrew. He says, Ela asa lishma mi'ahava. You can't just do the mitzvah. You have to do the mitzvah mamash l'shem shamayim mi'ahavat Hashem. That's the mitzvah that gets you to Olam Haba. What does that mean? So that brings us right back to where we started. Because in number 6, the Rambam in Hilchos Teshuvah explains that what is ahavat Hashem? What is ahavat Hashem? It's knowledge of God. Look at number 6. Davar yiduru boru. She'ein ahavas HaKadosh Baruch Hu niksheres b'livo shel Adam. The only way a person gets to ahavas Hashem, asheyishke boy tamid, until you focus on God constantly, karoy, appropriately. V'yazav kol mashe ba'olam chutz mimeni. You leave everything in the world apart from God. K'mo shetziva, as it says, v'ama v'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha. V'ein ha'oyiv HaKadosh Baruch Hu ele b'das she'yidi ehu. The only way you can know God, you can love God rather, is through knowing and understanding God. Al pi hadeya tihiya ha'ahava, according to how much you know and understand, that will be your ahava. Ve'im ma'at ma'at, ve'im harbe harbe. If it's little, then you'll know God a little, and you'll love God a little, and if you know God a lot, then you'll love God a lot. There's no point just going round with no knowledge, burning with desire for ahava Hashem. Says the Rambam, it's meaningless. What are you loving? You don't even know what you're loving. It's like saying, I love my wife, I've never met her. So what can you love? Love at first sight. It's ridiculous. You don't love them. It's not a love relationship. So the Rambam says clearly that even though he says you can do a mitzvah, may Ahavas Hashem, what is that Ahavas Hashem? He's back to where he started, which is you have to know why you're doing it. You have to understand it. You have to come to an understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is fundamental to the mitzvahs. The other place that the Rambam seems to talk about this is in the Mishneh Torah, which is in number 7, but I'm actually going to skip this for now because I think we need to move on to some other things and look at some other reasons. So according to this first reason, why did the Rambam write the Yud Gimel Ikrim? The answer is because the common man was losing sight of what gets people to Olam Haba. What gets you to Olam Haba is correct understanding, correct beliefs, and correct thoughts about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the world. There the Rambam is saying, this is what you have to think, understand it well, and like we said last time, he said you can't just read it through once, recite it and say, I understand it. We saw that source last week. He says you have to read it 10 times. Even if you read it 10 times, and you think you understood it, says the Rambam, you understood nothing. You have to read it another 10 times. So the Rambam wants this to be a study for you to go over, and again, not the Ani Ma'amins, that's just some later summary, but what he wrote and how he understands it. Now, have a look at page 3, number 8. There are a number of other approaches as to why it could be that the Rambam wrote the Yud Gimel Ikrim. One approach is what I've called here the commentary approach, which is a little bit different, which is a little bit more prosaic. Which is the Rambam wrote them because he had to, because that's what Chazal said, and he was just trying to explain Chazal. How so? Because if you look in number 8, I quoted you the Mishnah that the Rambam is commenting on. Remember where the Rambam wrote the Yud Gimel Ikrim. He was writing a commentary on the Mishnah. And he got to this place in the Mishnah, and he said, I can't explain this Mishnah without giving you an introduction, and here's my introduction about who is a Jew and what you have to believe, etc. What is that Mishnah? So if you look at number 8, he says like this, Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chaylik le'olam haba, sh'ne'ema, v'ameh kulam sadikim le'olam yirshu oretz. They will inherit the earth here, the land means olam haba. Ve'elu, says the Mishnah, she'ein lehem chaylik le'olam haba. And he gives 3 categories. Ha'aimer, someone who says, Ein Tchias HaMesim min HaTorah, that there is no Tchias HaMesim in the Torah. 2, I put these 1, 2, and 3 in. The Ein Torah min HaShemayim, someone says, Ein Torah min HaShemayim. And 3, Apikoros. So the first approach in the Mishnah there is that there are 3 categories of people who lose their Chalikim Olam Haba. Someone who doesn't believe in Tchias HaMesim, someone who doesn't believe in Torah min HaShemayim, and someone who does not, someone who is an Apikoros. Now, comes along the Abarbanel and says, number 9, Maimonides did not present these principles and foundations because the Torah would collapse with the refutation of any one of them. He says, no, I don't think that you need these to be able to get to Olam Haba to understand the Torah. Rather, it was his intention to explain the Mishnah, which says all Israel have a portion in the world to come. And just like the Mishnah divides them into 3 categories, we'll see that the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikrim are also basically in 3 categories. They can be easily subdivided as Ikrim that relate to how we understand God. That's Apikoros. Ikrim that relate to how we understand Torah, which is Torah min HaShemayim. And the last Ikrim which relate to how we understand how God runs the world. Providence, Hashkacha process, which is what the Mishnah refers to as Tchias HaMesim, the idea that God will one day intervene and pull everybody up. So this is perhaps a less controversial approach, that the Rambam was just doing what he had to do, which is explain the Mishnah, and that's really what Chazal was doing all along. The third approach I brought here, which I call the scientific approach, is a little bit critical. There were many people who actually felt that the Rambam didn't do anyone any favors by writing the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Have a look at number 10 here. Maimonides and those who follow him were brought to postulate principles in the Divine Torah only because they were drawn after the custom of the non-Jewish scholars, as described in their books. For they saw in every science where the natural mathematical roots and principles, which ought not to be denied and argued against. Thus, when one doubts one of the assumptions of a science that contradicts it, it can be clarified and proved with first principles, since these are the roots on which the entire science is based. Our scholars, having been dispersed amongst the nations and having studied their books and sciences, learned from their deeds and copied their ways and customs with respect to the Divine Torah. They said, quote, how do these non-Jews pursue their sciences? Which is kind of a paraphrase of a very negative posuk of people who go looking after the way the non-Jews run the world. By positing first principles and roots upon which a science is based, I will do so also and postulate principles and foundations of the Divine Torah. The Abarbanel says the Rambam basically was copying non-Jewish thought processes. Torah doesn't need this. Torah doesn't want this. And the Rambam imposed this system on Torah thinking because he's read lots of Aristotle, he's read lots of non-Jewish books. They have principles and they break things down into categories, and therefore this is why he decided he had to do this with Torah as well. The Abarbanel is not being very, if you like, complimentary about that. And by the way, that's clear from the Rambam's process in Halacha as well. When the Rambam produced the Mishnah Torah, he was the first person to ever do anything like that. And every other codification of Jewish law has really been based on that since. If you read the Gemara is a very organic book. I'll come to you in a second. The Gemara is a very organic book. You can translate the Gemara into English and give it to a person who's never learned Gemara before, and it won't help at all. You ever read the Sonsino translation of the Gemara? It's just as inscrutable as the Aramaic. It's in English, but it makes no sense. Because every single part of the Gemara assumes that you know every other part of the Gemara. And it's written in a way which assumes so much that you just don't know what it's talking about. That's why Gemara is very, very hard. You read the beginning of page 1, it assumes that you've read to, you know, page 4,500. That's why, you know, Daf Yomi is very nice, but it never really takes you into the Gemara. Daf Yomi is like the open-top bus tour around the Gemara. You know, when you go, when you're a tourist, and you go to, like, Prague for the day, or Bratislava. You say, what am I going to do today? You say, I don't know, I don't visit Bratislava, I'll take the open-top bus. So you go on top of this bus, you sit with something in your ear, and you're going around, and it says, like, on your right, there is the Royal Palace. And just as they say that, it turns the other way, and you're going, where is that? Where is that? Where is that? What did they say? I can't, it's not working right. Yeah? You've all been on these things. Now, what is the purpose? Do you now know Bratislava? No, you don't know anything. But, you know one thing. You know where everything roughly is, and if you ever want to come back and visit the Royal Palace, you say, ah, yeah, that was kind of over there, we'll come back and visit there one day. That's the same with Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi is a wonderful thing, but they whiz you through the Gemara on this open-top bus, and just as you get to anything, you whiz straight past it. You know, why is it that they can cover two amudim of Daf Yomi in an hour session, and yet in the Mi Yeshiva they seem to take like 9 weeks, learning 8 hours a day to cover the same material? Is it because the people in the Mir Yeshiva are a bit slower? I don't think so. And therefore the Gemara is very, very tricky. What the Rambam did to the Gemara, of course, which was itself controversial, nothing to do with philosophy, but just the halacha, is he took the entire structure of the Gemara and he said, we don't need all this. It's all very kind of organic. Let's upload it into our brain, which he did, unbelievably, reformat it completely, turn it into very linear, kind of chapter 1, halacha 1, X, Y, Z, da da da, and then reformat it into a completely new format, to the point that he said, you don't need to learn the sources anymore, I'm not even going to give you any sources. Here it is, in a way that a non-Jewish or a secularly trained person can understand. You can copy the Rambam into English, give it to a non-Jewish person or a Jewish person who's never learned anything, and they'll understand it the first second they read it, because it makes sense. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So the Rambam, if you like, didn't just do that with Hashkofa, he did that across the board. He reorganized things in a way that we, perhaps now, take for granted, but which was very, very radical at the time. And it's very non-Talmudic. You had a question. Go with the... Yes. The only problem with that is that when the Rambam writes the Yud Gimel Ikrim, he cross-references through to the Mor Nevuchim and things like that. And the Yud Gimel Ikrim are written for the everyday person. And it seems that he wants you to understand things that he's written in the Mor Nevuchim in order to understand the Yud Gimel Ikrim as well. The Rambam doesn't write the Mor Nevuchim in a total vacuum and dissociate it from the rest of his writings. To some degree, we've done that. Yes, they are okay. They think they're okay. It could be that they're misunderstanding some things. Look, it's not for little me to, you know, mi ani lachnis roshi ben haharim, as they say. There are great people who take that view, but which is that the Mor Nevuchim is not written for us; it's written for them, whoever they are. Right. Okay. Well, that's all very well, but it seems from when you start to read the Mor Nevuchim, it doesn't sound like that. The Mor Nevuchim starts off with an understanding of what does the Chumash mean? What does it mean when you're to have a Tselem Elokim? The first chapter in the Moreh Nevuchim talks about that. What is that? What does the Chumash mean by that? What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu mean by writing that down? What do you think that means? It sounds to me that that is something that every single Jew should have a good understanding of. And if they don't read the Moreh Nevuchim and they walk around thinking, I don't know, I look like God, God looks like me. That's a very, very major mistake. Well, I teach a lot of people who've just been through a chinuch process, and I ask them, what does it mean that you have a Tselem Elokim? And they don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. What does it mean that you have a Tselem Elokim? I ask people who've been through 12 years of high school education or whatever, and they can't actually tell me.
I've heard some of it in school. Some of them are obviously very small.
So maybe Moreh Nevuchim was written for today's world after. I don't know. It's a good question. By the way, it's always possible to do that. There's a big debate of a similar nature with Rav Hirsch. Did Rav Hirsch mean anything that he said? When he tells you, when Rav Hirsch tells you that Torah im Derech Eretz is the way to lead a perfected Jewish life, and you have to combine secular studies and a life in work and being a Kiddush Hashem and combine that with Torah and do that, is Rav Hirsch, does he really mean it, or is he just writing it for Kirov?
It's politically correct to say that he only meant that this time in Germany.
That's right. It's always possible. It's always possible to take a revisionist view and rewrite history the way that suits us to think of it today. And Rav Hirsch has been subject to that analysis. Rav Shimon Schwab has a very interesting set of essays called These and Those, which are available in English, which he debates this question. He tries to understand, did Rav Hirsch mean it or did Rav Hirsch didn't mean it? Many people get through life very happily ignoring everything Rav Hirsch says by convincing themselves he never really meant it. Okay, it's possible. You can live like an ostrich. It's always possible. Yes?
What about the real differences regarding Korbanot in the Nevuchim, in the Moran Nevuchim, or in...
Right, so you're asking, it's a little bit off topic, but you're asking a question which I'll either answer now or I'll tell you I'll answer later and then hopefully answer later. I'll answer it quickly now and we'll deal with it more later. You're asking that it sounds like in the Moreh Nevuchim, korbanos are a temporary measure. They're there to wean us off the more vulgar, basic human sacrifice mentality that the pagan world had. You can't change people overnight, and therefore you first have to take them through a process of, you know, they can throw around a bit of animal blood for a while, and then eventually they'll get to a point where, etc. The problem, of course, with that is that the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah himself clearly writes that when Mashiach comes, we will bring back the korbanos exactly as they were before. In fact, I can compound your question by saying that the Ramban, Nachmanides, who so disagrees with the Rambam on his analysis of korbanos in the time of the Midbar, says they were fundamental and intrinsic to Judaism. He says that when Mashiach comes, we won't have any korbanos anymore. Okay? Because the halacha will change and we will be in a supernatural world that doesn't require it. So everything seems to be a little bit on its head. So I really, really compounded your question. But, you know, the Rambam doesn't understand that we are now necessarily any further ahead. That you're assuming that we're now much further ahead than they were in the Dor HaMidbar. I'm not sure that the Rambam necessarily makes that assumption. That whatever they needed then, we still need now.
I'm not making that statement.
But you're saying, how do they two match together?
Correct.
There are differences between them. Rav Kook, of course, synthesizes the two to some degree and says that whilst at the beginning of Yom HaMashiach we'll have korbanos, by the end of Yom HaMashiach we'll have only vegetarian korbanos. And he has in his commentary on the Chumash, on the Siddur, in his Oles Raya, he on what we say at the end of the Shemona Esrei, the Arva Lashem Minchas Yudav Yerushalayim. Minchas Yudav Yerushalayim. We talk about the mincha that we will, the mincha, just like the days of old, we will offer the mincha. The mincha is a vegetarian korban. There were lots of vegetarian korbanos. Flour, oil, water, wine, etc. We're going to a vegetarian era, which is one of the reasons why many of his Ki Talmidim became very strict vegetarians, but that's not for now. Now, let us move quickly ahead, because there's much we have to do. There are other approaches which I won't tie you down with. There's definitely a polemic approach, which is the Rambam. You know, the Muslims and the Christians became very fixated at the time with what do we believe. They start to burn people at the stake and to threaten conversion on people. So the Jews also need to know, well, what do we believe? They say they believe this, or what do we believe? All of a sudden it becomes necessary to define what people believe. And he talks in the uncensored versions of the Mishneh Torah, because I think I mentioned last time, much of what we have today, both of the Gemara and the Rambam, is the Christian censored version. But in the uncensored version, he talks about the fact that we need to understand what we believe, because the Notrim and the Hagarim, the Christians and the Muslims, say X, and we have to know that we have to say Y. Turn over the page to page 4 for a second. Another two possibilities that I've seen brought down as to why the Rambam wrote the Yuvgal and Ikrim, one of them is what I call here the philosophical approach, which is by tying down Jewish philosophy to these 13 things and saying these 13 things are the things you have to believe, it basically means that everything else is up for grabs. Because in a sense, the Rambam is a very philosophically minded writer, and he's now allowed himself the latitude with everything else other than these 13 things to take different views. For example, there are apparent philosophical principles which do not seem to be in the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Creation ex nihilo, freedom of choice. We will see where they may indeed appear in the Yud Gimel Ikrim. But to the extent that things are not in the Yud Gimel Ikrim, it opens the realms for other things. For example, the Rambam has some very strong hashgafic approaches towards things like Shadim and Mazikim. He said that they don't exist. There are no such things. That astrology is complete nonsense. That it doesn't have any effect on anybody. And other people at the time had very clear views which thought like that. And the Rambam said, there's no reason why I can't take that view. That's my view. It's not one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, etc. Anyway, he wrote the Yud Gimel Ikrim, so it makes a bit different. But he says clearly in his introduction to the Shmona Prakim in Pirkei Avos, he says that I believe in taking truth from wherever it comes. If it comes from Aristotle, it comes from Aristotle. If it comes from Plato, it comes from Plato. And therefore, if you like, he's opening up the field, apart from these 13 areas, for people to bring in different issues. So one approach is that. And the last approach I brought you is what I call the Parshanut approach, which is very interesting, that the Rambam, in don't forget, the Yud Gimel Ikrim is not the only thing that appears in Perek Chelek, his introduction to Perek Chelek. The first part of the Yud Gimel Ikrim is the Rambam's thesis on Midrash, which is also very interesting, and not really for this session, but the Rambam, you speak to Simi about it, but the Rambam's attitude towards Midrash, which is that almost all Midrashim have to be read in a non-literal way. Midrash Agadah. Midrash Halacha. Midrash Agadah. Has to be written, learnt in a non-literal way. And indeed, he takes non-literalism into the Psukim as well, like we saw before with Malachim, etc. There comes a point when you have to draw some lines, like Maimonides, what is literal? What can we turn around and say, this is fixed and no further, we can't go beyond this line, where are our lines going to be? By having opened up the whole non-literal debate, he then has to draw some clear lines and say, look, these 13 things, these things you have to believe. Everything else, okay, everything else is subject to different interpretations, etc., etc. That's one approach, and people, you know, to this day feel uncomfortable with the non-literalism of the Rambam, because it does open these questions. And if the Malachim are not literally true, then what is? What about this? What about that? Etc. And you end up with a conservative or reformed Judaism where you're beginning to take everything in a non-literal way, including halacha, etc., etc. Now, the last part of the class actually is very important, and I'm glad we've got like 15 minutes left, because I want to talk about something else. I want to talk about the structure of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, because that will allow us then to get into the Yud Gimel Ikrim next week, Netz Hashem. Rav Yosef Albo, who came a couple of hundred years after the Rambam, he lived in the 1400s in Spain, he wrote a book called Sefer HaIkrim, not to be confused with the Rambam's Ikrim. He wrote a book called Sefer HaIkrim, where he posits that there are three Ikrim. What are the three Ikrim? So if you look here, what he says at the very beginning, HaDerech HaNochel Shiyir LeBesfirut HaIkrim, Besfirat HaIkrim, the way you have to count the Ikrim, Shehem Shroshim v'yisodot l'Torah, they are foundations to Torah, Ha'elokit, who they are the foundations of the divine Torah. Ke'ikrim ha'kolim v'ha'chreichim, the necessary ikrim, which are required, l'data elokit, for the divine knowledge, hein shlosha. There are only three ikrim, he says. Ve'hein mitziyut Hashem, the existence of God. Ha'hashkacha l'tchava onesh, the God intervening in the world and there being implications to our actions, reward and punishment. The Torah min hashamayim. Elu hashloisha, these three, he says, haim avos, these are the primaries, L'chola ikrim asher ledatot ha'elokit. V'tachas kol ikrim ha'elu shroshim. And underneath these, tachas kol ikrim ha'elu, shroshim v'sif'im, mishtagrim u'mistafim in ha'ikah ha'hu. Each one of them has subcategories. In other words, the Sefer Ikrim understands that there are basically three Ikrim. God, Torah, and Hashgacha. And underneath these three Ikrim, all other principles of the Jewish faith kind of can be categorized. And if you skip to the last paragraph after the ellipsis there, after the dots, he says like this. The Efshe could be Kidas HaRambam B'mispara Ikrim, when the Rambam says, I guess it gives his count of the Ikrim, which is 13, Hu al zeh derech shekasavnu, it's actually the way we said it. In other words, he said, actually, I think this is what the Rambam did too. And a Shahumana Hagimel, he counted these three Ikrim, Shamarna, which we just discussed, Shehem Abois, these are the primary Ikrim, Imash Roshim Hamistafi Mehem, he counted the subsidiaries as well. Makaros and Kulam Ikrim, he called them all Ikrim. And basically, he then explains how you can look at the 13 Ikrim, and you can see very clearly what are the 13 Ikrim. So the first five Ikrim, which are the existence of God, that God is one, that God has no body, that God is beyond time, and that God is the only person we may pray to, they are all talking about the nature of God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, man's understanding of God. The next 1, 2, 3, 4 Ikrim, which are all related to Torah, are that God communicates with a human being through prophecy, the Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy was fundamentally different from every other, the Torah is min hashamayim, and that the Torah will never change. So these are all under the category of Torah. And the last four Ikrim, which is 10, 11, 12, 13, that God knows everything we think and do, that God rewards and punishes for keeping the mitzvot, that there will be an ultimate reward at the end of days, which is Mashiach, and then eventually there will be Tchias HaMesim, these are all related to Hashgacha, the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. So this threefold division is very easily compatible with the Rambam's 13 Ikrim in the way that he's ordered them. And that's the thesis of the Yud Gimel Ikrim. And he even founded it on something very fascinating. He founded it on the Posek in Yeshaya. If you look at the Posek in Yeshaya number 13, he says, Yeshaya comes along and says, Ki Hashem Shofteinu, Hashem Mechokekeinu, Hashem Malkeinu, Hu Yoshienu. What is Hashem? He's Shofteinu, which is a judge, which is Chava Onesh, which is reward and punishment. He's a Mechokek, which is a lawgiver, which is Torah. And he's a Melech, which is the Adon HaKol, which is the ruler, which is the first cause, etc., etc. And he makes a very beautiful idea. We can think of this idea next year on Rosh Hashanah. He develops this idea in the Sefer Ikrim, and he says, this is also, we find this theme, this threefold theme, cropping up again and again in Judaism. He wants to bring it out on Rosh Hashanah with the Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros. Look at what he says in number 14. The Amoral Hayos Gimel Ikrim Halala. Once you understand that these three Ikrim, Shorish V'Yisoy Le'emunah, which are the basis of our entire Emunah, Asher Bo Yegiya Ha'adam Ela Hatzlachato V'Amitit, a person can come to their true success. Hu Mashi Yastu Lano Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. This is why the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah founded for us B'Tfilat Musaf Shal Rosh Hashanah Gimel Brochas. They made these three special brochas, Shehem Malchias, Zichronos, V'Shofros, Shehem Keneged Gimel Ikrim Halalu. Lahir Leva Adam said that we will come to understand Ki Ha'amonas Ha'ikrim Halalu are the things that bring us to the next world. And it's very easy to understand that Malchios is HaKadosh Baruch Hu as king, as the nature of Hashem, that Hashem is the first cause and is one, etc. Zichronos is that Hashem remembers the world, which is Hashkocha and Shava Ones. And Shofros, if you look at the Psukim of Shofros, you'll see that they're all related to the giving of the Torah, of Har Sinai, etc., etc. But what I've done for you on page 5, I think is rather interesting, which is other areas in Jewish life that I think you can see this threefold division as really fundamental as a pillar of Judaism. The idea of God as the existence of God, Torah from God, and divine providence. I think it comes not only in Malchus, Shofros, and Zichronos, but it comes clearly in Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. If you look at the themes, the basic underlying themes of those Chagim, they fit into these ideas of Pesach being the birth and the existence of the world and the HaKadosh Baruch Hu being there for the Jewish people, Shavuos, which is the giving of the Torah, and Sukkos, which is the protective nature of sitting in the Sukkah, etc. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the brochas that we say when we daven Shacharis in the morning. Fascinating. Yotze Or, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu as creator of the world. Ahava Rabba, which connects very strongly with the giving of the Torah. The Gemara even says if a person forgot to say Birkas HaTorah in the morning, they can be Yotzi Birkas HaTorah with Ahava Rabba. And Ga'al Yisrael, which is talking about providence and HaKadosh Baruch Hu bringing us eventually back, and Ge'ula, etc. It's even related on Shabbos, if you think about it, with Friday night davening, Shabbos morning davening, and Shabbos afternoon davening. Friday night davening is themed around creation, by Chul HaShemayim V'aretz V'chol Tzva'am. Yeah? Shabbos morning is completely focused on Nisinei HaTorah. Yismach Moshe V'machnas Chelkoi Ki Eved Nam Kas Alayk Tesha Luchoi Savanim. And Shabbos afternoon is Hashkocha, Ata Eichod V'Shimcha Eichod, and we talk about Geula and Gimus HaMashiach, etc., etc. And these are the Ikrim, of course, of Rambam, Yosef Albo and the Rambam, and on a more Kabbalistic level, which I'm not getting into, it's also connected with the idea of Shabbos is feminine, Ba, yeah, V'inuchu Va, Yisrael, Mekadoshei Shemecha, V'inuchu Va, Yisrael, Mekadoshei Shemecha, V'inuchu Vam. It's all connected in many ways. So I think that one can see these three fundamental pillars which come up again and again and again, and you can add to that list, and if you add to that list, please send me an email, if you see a theme, if you see a pattern in Judaism where these three things are coming out. I occasionally think of them but forget to write them down, but this is the best list I've got right now, but there may be others which you can tell me now or later. The last thing I want you to look at here is the following, and this will really come bring us to an end of the introductory sessions as to understanding what the Yogim Ikrim are, which is as follows. There are other people that had different lists of the Ikrim. For example, Rav Chisdai Kreskes. Rav Chisdai Kreskes is someone that we don't really know very well in mainstream Jewish life, although he's very, very important as a figure in these areas. Rav Chisdai Kreskes was the Rebbe of Rav Yosef Albo. And we'll talk a little bit more about him as we go through. He also lived in Spain in the 1400s, or 1300s, 1400s, just at the turn to the persecutions in Spain. And he writes basically that there are six Ikrim, which he recounts in number 16 as God's knowledge of the world, providence, God's power, prophecy, freedom of choice, and purposefulness of Torah. In other words, you can go through many different writers writing many different Ikrim. And I want to finish with a comment from Rav Bleich to try and sort of put a bit of a context to why all of these people are saying different lists of the Ikrim. Why are they all disagreeing with each other? So let's just look at what he says and we'll finish with this. Number 17. It appears, says Rav Bleich. By the way, Rav Bleich wrote a very good book on this. I gave you a bibliography last week called Imperfect Faith. It's a very thick book. You can pick it up, it's quite expensive. Most of it is just quotes, English translations of relevant people on these issues, but he has a few things of his own writings there as well. And he says this is part of what Rav Bleich says there. It appears that in compiling divergent lists of principles, Maimonides, Kreskes, and Albo are not so much in disagreement with regards to substantive teachings or the need to accept these teachings as divinely revealed truths, although they do exist disagreements with regards to the nature and status of the principles, as they are with regard to what it is that they are endeavoring to formulate. What are they trying to do? Rav Albo is intent on formulating a system of axioms consisting of the sine qua non of a system of religious belief. Every theological system must by definition posit the existence of God and the concepts of revelation and the concepts of reward and punishment. Kreskes, on the other hand, is not concerned with the premises of religious belief in general, but with the unique claims of faith set forth by Judaism. And therefore he talks about the very Jewish nature of religion. Kreskes presents the distinct demands which Judaism makes on faith and formulates the beliefs which are unique to Judaism, which are things like free choice, prophecy, etc. Finally, and this really brings to an end what we're seeing about the Rambam, Maimonides, depending on which explanation is accepted, either presents the particular beliefs which require bolstering and reinforcement, or enumerates, and this is what we said at the beginning, the minimum concept of the theological knowledge necessary for the development of the acquired intellect, which in turn makes possible the reality of immortality. Which is what we said, clearly, it's not just me that says this, Rav Bleich clearly understands that what the Rambam's trying to do here is give us the minimum, bare bones, to be able to get us into Olam Haba by getting our heads straight. Now, this brings to an end our introduction. I will introduce now, just in a line, what we're going to do next time and the time after, by the following. One of the problems with learning the Rambam is the Rambam states at the beginning of the Mor Nebuchim that there are many reasons why you find contradictions in books. One reason why you find contradictions in books is that clever writers put contradictions in there for clever readers. So that when you read them, you'll realize, hello, something's going on here that is obviously drawing to my attention. This contradicts to the what is the Rambam really trying to say. And the Rambam says, this is what you will find in the Mor Nevuchim. He says, this is the way Chazal wrote their Hashkofa in the Midrashim, in the Agadot, in the Gemara. There are things which contradict each other because they want you to look at it more deeply. And he even suggests, we'll see the source, that this is how the Tanakh itself is written, in a way which contradicts itself in order to get you to look at things deeply. This will bring us to a bit of an issue, which is whenever we say, aha, so the Rambam means this, we're always going to have to ask ourselves, well, does he really mean that? Or is he actually saying this? Because this is part of the study of the Rambam which makes the Rambam difficult. Exoteric and esoteric understandings of the Rambam are one of the mainstays of academic research on the Rambam, which we're not going to get into because that's not what we're here to develop an academic syllabus on Maimonides. But we always have to be on guard. And we're going to see this clearly, and this is in the traditional Mephoshim as well, that when the Rambam says, I believe this, and you have to believe that, sometimes he doesn't mean that. And he means something which is a little bit different. And we have to try and work out why he says it like he says it and what he really wants us to understand. We'll see this in a few places, which is one of the reasons that it becomes much a very exciting study, but it makes it quite a difficult study. But we will, starting from next time, Yom Hashem, next time we're going to look at the first three of the Ikrim, and we'll see how far we get. Okay? Have a lovely day.